All right, Chill. Welcome to the show. How's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're here every weekday from 3 to 5. Every 3 to 5 p.m. on the weekdays here on the Liberty Express. And on Daily Paul Radio, too. And at scotthorton.org/listen. That's my website, scotthorton.org. If you like listening to me interview people, I got 3,000 of them there at scotthorton.org/interviews. And you can find the whole show archives at /show. And you can join up the chat room if you want at scotthorton.org/chat. See how I got that whole /this and /that thing happening there? Isn't it great? All right. scotthorton.org. I'm in the chat room. Hey, chat room guys, how's things? Today I got a good show for you. Ray McGovern's going to be here. And we're going to, I'm going to try to sit there quietly and let Ray talk about Robert Gates. And tell the truth about Robert Gates. Who Robert Gates is. As, you know, compared to the PR. And why ask Ray McGovern? Well, because he was a CIA analyst for 27 years. He knows Bobby Gates, as Ray calls him. And he doesn't respect him either, and he doesn't know a reason to. Which is coincidental, because I don't know of any reasons to respect Robert Gates either. Other than, I guess, if one, which wouldn't include me, but if one really admires achievements in public relations campaigns, then yeah, he's been successful at making people think things. I wouldn't call that admirable, but you could call it successful, you know, positive in that sense. Yeah, I one time did a thing on Iranian TV, on Press TV, about Robert Gates. You can find it on my YouTube channel. And it was, Robert Gates is going to retire, so what now? And what they did, you know, they recorded three different interviews at three different times, and then they kind of spliced them together and whatever. So everybody else is being all respectful. I was just, I think I remember watching it a long time later and kind of laughing. Man, I don't know. I really let him have it. All right, well, Robert Gates is going to let him have it here on the show today. That'll be good. And then John Pfeffer, he wrote two things I want to question him for. The first one is about Iraq. What does America owe Iraq? What does the American government owe the people of Iraq? What do the people of America owe the people of Iraq? Or the government of Iraq? Or the whatever of something? The Pottery Barn Rule. It actually is a terrible smear against the Pottery Barn. They never had anything to do with lying us into war. It was the Office of Special Plans working on behalf of Ariel Sharon. Well, and the president, the vice president of America, but that's sort of beside the point, isn't it? It wasn't the Pottery Barn that ruled that we had to invade Iraq, but that was what Colin Powell claimed. Once you invade it, you have to stay there and keep killing it and killing it. Anyway, is that the rule? That was never the rule. In fact, Thomas Friedman, pseudo-intellectual, made it up out of whole cloth, as Pfeffer reminds us in his article. And just think about that. If they did have a rule like that, that if you break it, you bought it, and you went into the Pottery Barn, and you broke a pot, and then you went, oh, goodness, here, let me fix it and make it better. And then in the process, you just kept knocking stuff over. And then they decided to waive their rule about how everything is your problem once you destroy it. If only you will just go and stop destroying more pottery, then wouldn't you have an obligation to the property owner to exit the premises rather than defying his wishes in the name of putting Humpty Dumpty back together again? Oh, don't worry, I can fix it as another entire shelf topples over. 1,000 more pieces of, clay are shattered. It's a bad analogy, but I like it anyway, so. Yeah. America. Anyway, so, Ray on about Robert Gates, John Pfeffer on about Iraq. Oh, and also, he's got this great new thing in the Tom Dispatch. It'll be running at antiwar.com tomorrow for certain. And it's about the pivot to Asia. And you know what? I don't want to give out any more than that. I don't want to spoil it for you. I mean, you can go to tomdispatch.com and go read it for yourself if you want. But there's something to it. It's not just, hey, let's talk about the Asia pivot. He's got a point to make about the Asia pivot that I think you'll be interested in listening for. Two. So that'll be the great John Pfeffer from Foreign Policy and Focus. He'll be coming up on this show here in a little while, too. And then, other than that, I got a ton of things to talk about. So now, I better look at my notes and remind myself about all the different things I had to talk about. Really, the hard part is just choosing the chronology. Let's start with the cops. Woman arrested for small amount of pot dies in jail after being denied prescriptions by cops. I'll try to keep this brief. Of course, I got a thousand different things to say about it. But anyway, I guess the first thing to say about it is the only reason we're hearing about this is because she was a blonde white lady. If she was a black lady, it wouldn't even be a news story in any circumstances unless, I don't know, she was related to a sports star or something. Otherwise, it'd just be another corpse on the pile as far as the state and the media are concerned. But anyway, so this blonde white lady, she went from Kansas to Colorado to get some pot because she was a degenerate freak. No, because she was sick, terribly sick. And the pot made her feel better. And yet, there are totalitarian police state communist laws in Kansas that say that she can't possess or use pot. So she went to Denver to buy some on the open market, but then to smuggle it back home. And she got caught with a tiny little bit, too. Pulled over for speeding. Don't mind if we search your car, do ya? Not that they had probable cause. And anyway, arrested her for a small amount of pot. And then once she's in the jail, she's just another murderer in there. So when she's laying there dying on the floor, and I believe it's her sister was in there with her, explaining that, like, hey, she's got terrible ailments, but she's got the medicine. Let us get the medicine. Well, according to Kansas.com, which, great URL, guys, Kansas.com, they say, jailers would not give Sewell her medications because she kept them in a daily pill container instead of the original bottles. And jailers were unable to identify the pills. I'm sure they rushed over to Google to see whether, you know, this pill should be this color or have this letter carved in it or something, right? Biggs, who was too distraught to talk about the incident Thursday, told the family Sewell had not been feeling well since Monday. Jailers sent her to a hospital on Tuesday and then returned her to the jail. Early Wednesday, she began foaming at the mouth. Biggs told her family, it was her friend, I guess, she pleaded for jailers to help while she began cardiopulmonary resuscitation. The family believes the jailers should have responded faster. What a very nice way of saying they are guilty, and you all know, too, that they are guilty as hell of indifference and standing there and letting this woman die. Like she's less than a dog. You wouldn't let that happen to a dog. But that's how a local sheriff's deputy treats the suspects being held, you know, for their own protection. So that their rights are protected before their fair trial. And they left her there to die like she was already a corpse. Like she wasn't a human being. And they sat there and they let her die. And what was she in for? A little bit of weed. Oh, well, that's against the law. And why wouldn't they give her medicine other than she was less than a dog because she wasn't a government employee? A sheriff's department or state police employee, not part of their gang. Well, she didn't have the prescription bottles. She only had her daily, you know, the little things that have the days of the week on them. for your pill takings. And so I'm sorry, you know, the federal law and the prescription, this, that, and the other Federal Register code. And so she's dead for the war on drugs. Somebody's mother murdered by the state. And every single person who supports the war on drugs in America, and for that matter, everybody in America who supports the existence of the FDA, they're responsible for murdering her. All is yes. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it easy and 100% anonymous. Just deposit the money into their account at any Bank of America, Wells Fargo, or credit union with shared branching, and then just email them a picture of the receipt with your Bitcoin address and you get your Bitcoins. A simple, clean, anonymous way to get Bitcoins. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Hey, I'm Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right. Well, aside from the fact that I tripped all over my tongue on the way out to break there, I'm right. It's just mean to support the war on drugs at this point. Whatever good idea anybody ever had, whatever decent motive anyone ever had, for supporting or maintaining a war on drugs in America, your stupid, wrong opinion has been proven wrong. Innocent people are dead. It's because of the stupid, wrong things you believe. Stop it. Drug-free America. Does anyone, does the most naive anti in America believe that one day there won't be much coke or meth or pot or heroin around? You know, in the 50 states. Never mind Alaska and Hawaii. But just in the area between San Diego and Bangor, Maine there. You figure, what, one day the government, somehow a government program, is going to eradicate drugs? Or eradicate people who want to use drugs? Right, okay, so there is no drug-free America because that's stupid. So then what is it instead? A permanent counterinsurgency campaign against the black market? And you just murdered somebody's mom over a little bit of pot. How many conservatives listening think, hey, she went to Colorado to buy some pot, crossed the line back into Kansas? Huh, that's breaking the law. That's what you get. Too bad, so sad for you, sick woman who thought she might benefit from pot. Guess you know better now that you're dead, that you'd have been better off sick without pot in Kansas. Because then what you did instead was you got pot and dead, murdered by the cops. And you know what? Here's the thing, too. It's a very important sociological sort of a thingamajig going on there in your local county jail and every county jail, where people die all the time in weird circumstances, and a lot of them being, you know, of illnesses where they need immediate help. But the attitude is, you're all guilty of murder. You're all the lowest scum of the earth. And so nobody gets any deference, any, you know, considered treatment whatsoever. Everybody gets the very least of what they are absolutely mandated to do for you. And oftentimes less than that. I know a guy. In fact, you know, no offense if he's listening, he's probably not. He's the worst scumbag I know. I mean, he's kind of a good guy, but he's a pretty bad scumbag too, you know? And he became a Travis County deputy sheriff because he thought you got to have good sheriffs who understand the Bill of Rights and stuff like that, or else you're giving it over to bad guys. And so sometimes good people who care about the Bill of Rights have got to become cops. And they start him off at the Travis County jail. And Travis County sheriffs have a reputation, at least when I was growing up, they had a reputation of being certainly less bad than the Williamson County Gestapo, you know? But he only lasted 10 months. He couldn't stand it. And it was the basic thing was, hey, can I have a pencil? Hey, can I go to the bathroom? Hey, can I... the most basic decency. He got in trouble any time that he said yes. Anytime somebody called from their cell and he answered. Anytime they asked for anything and he said sure. It was, what are you doing, man? That's not how it works. They're the scum of the earth. We're the gods on Mount Olympus. These are all people who are, you know, presumably all of them innocent, law-abiding citizens who the state has yet to even charge with anything, most of them. And they're treated like the absolute scum of the earth because, hey, to give them an inch is to give them a mile. To let the camel's nose under the tent, you show them the slightest bit of decency, now you have to be decent to them all the time. And so that's just not how it works. You know, it's just like the Stanford prison experiment. In real life, with your local sheriffs on a day-to-day basis, and your local deputy sheriffs, that's how they treat people, the scum of the earth. So who is this lady? A perfectly wonderful law-abiding citizen. She wasn't some crackhead prostitute, scum of the earth, even though crackhead prostitutes are people too. But anyway, she was no one who deserved to be seen, or who you would even guess, you ought to have to guess, would be seen as less than human or scum of the earth by the people at the holding cell here. She's a white lady with blonde hair, a law-abiding citizen, presumably, you know, I don't know, she has a family, presumably a job, right? It's not like they, you know, picked her up for dealing herself and meth in the back alley behind the motel again or anything like that. She's just a regular lady, somebody's mom with a little bit of pot. And she's sitting there dying on the floor, and they let her die on the floor. Man, we could be talking about history, about some horrible totalitarian country. Yeah, well, you know how it used to be back under the regime of, what's his name in communist Romania. Yeah, they let you die on the floor of the cell before they give you your pills that you brought with you. And that's going on in your town, in your country. That's how it works. That's the incentive structure of having a monopoly security force. It becomes very quickly, in their mind, a war of them versus us. They're the gods and we're the nobodies. The mundanes, as William Griggs says. And you know what, too? Check this out, man. Radley Balco, who, I got my problems with Radley Balco, but man, they all went away when I read this thing. Jeez, I don't remember what any of them are anymore. He's now writing for the Washington Post, which is good news, because that means his view is being exposed to a lot of people who would have never heard him. And this article, this is just insane. This is so good. I mean, especially, like, I don't know, if you guys are conservative Christians out there at all, you ought to print this one out and give it to your pastor and have him make a sermon out of the thing or something. I mean, this is something else, man. It's drugs versus the drug war. A response to Michael Gerson. Now, Michael Gerson is a former George W. Bush speechwriter, and he wrote a thing for the Washington Post, wrote a column urging conservatives to reject libertarianism. And part of his argument, which Balco says, yeah, well, libertarianism is the exact opposite of conservatism, so it would make sense for conservatives to not agree with it. But anyway, he makes this ridiculous conservative argument for the war on drugs. And he sounds like some fantastical sociology, 101 student to me. Oh yeah, let's remake society with state power. What communism is this? Oh, but it's Michael Gerson, the conservative. And he says, oh no, government has a necessary, if limited, which of course here he's talking about an unlimited role for them to do anything. Ultimately, he's talking about an unlimited government in practice when you look at how the drug war is implemented, of course. But he just has to say limited because, hey, nice buzzword. Government has a necessary role in reinforcing the social norms and expectations that make the work of civic institutions both possible and easier. That doesn't sound like a junior college sociology professor, Bolshevik, Stalinist, communist to you? I actually had a Bolshevik, communist, Stalinist. Oh, he said he was a social democrat Trotskyite, but he wasn't. He was a communist totalitarian, junior high school sociology professor. And this is what he talked like. Yeah, government making society how I want it. Only, oh, but this guy's a right winger because he claims that he's not a Stalinist. Okay, fine. Oh, yeah. No, because we can't be happy unless government reinforces norms. Like you shouldn't use drugs. And then here's what happens to Michael Gerson after he makes this ridiculous, pathetic tenth of an argument for the war on drugs. Radley Balco says, okay, fine. You want to talk about what's good or bad for society? It seems only fair that you talk about the consequences of prohibition. How about that? And then, holy crap, this guy must have just finished writing a book about the militarization of police or something, because he comes out with the stats, blams Michael Gerson, destroys Michael Gerson. There's no way, if Michael Gerson is smart, he should just not even respond to this at all. I guarantee you he's got nothing to say to Radley Balco's ultimate destruction of that fake conservative argument that the national government has a role and is playing a successful role in conserving good old-fashioned American conservative values by waging a war on drugs. No, actually, they're destroying society in a thousand ways, and Balco proves it a thousand ways with science. Destroys Michael Gerson. Picture Michael Gerson's ugly face exploding like it just got took out by one of Harry Truman's atom bombs. Blam! Michael Gerson hangs himself from the rafters in his house today. He's done. Now, it's true that people will continue to suffer because of what Michael Gerson believes, unfortunately. And the police unions in America have a hell of a lot of power. They're basically the only ones anymore, other than a Stalinist conservative like Michael Gerson, who believe in the drug war anymore. Hey, that's our job you're talking about. Yeah, exactly. And here Balco's talking about little children who need medical pot to save them from their seizures. And Governor Christie tells this family, go to hell. The father says to Christie, don't let my daughter die. Legalize pot. Legalize medical pot for my daughter, please. And Chrissy goes, yeah, if I feel like it, if I think it's good for all of New Jersey later, yeah. Screw your daughter if she's having seizures and dying from it. And it was a terrible kind of epilepsy, too, or something. Go read this thing. It's Balco in the Washington Post, Drugs versus the Drug War, the ultimate destruction of the conservative argument for the war on drugs. Done. Gerson's goose cooked. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. The Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. The website is scotthorton.org here on Liberty Express Radio. And our first guest on the show today is our friend Ray McGovern. He used to be a CIA analyst, but he's a good guy now. He is an analyst there for 27 years. And he's one of the co-founders of the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, who tried to truth us out of war back in 2002, and is a great anti-war activist on a great many topics. You can find his articles at raymcgovern.com, but also at consortiumnews.com, and he's got a huge archive at antiwar.com as well. Welcome back to the show. Ray, how are you?
Thanks, Scott. Doing well. How are you?
I'm doing real good. I appreciate you joining us today. And so I wonder, who's Robert Gates? Go ahead.
Well, first I have to sort of put a little wrinkle on your introduction. The CIA analysts are good guys. Now, they were corrupted by Bobby Gates, but since then, and since kind of justifying an unjustifiable war under George Tenet and George Bush, since then, they've prevented a war with Iran and with Syria. And probably I should start out with that, because not that many people know the role that honest people in CIA, the analysis division, played when Bush and Cheney were going to hit Iran right before they rode off into the sunset. That was on the schedule for 2008, and I can prove it. Long story short, the analysis group of the CIA and the rest of the intelligence community got an honest guy in there named Tom Finger from the State Department. He ran an estimate which concluded in November of 2007 that Iran had stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003 and had not resumed work. Now, Bush's own memoir says that deprived me of the military option. You know, it was a eye stopper. Or how could I order our forces to attack a country that the intelligence community says has no active nuclear weapons program? Quote unquote. Bummer. So that did stop the juggernaut off to war. The Joint Chiefs of Staff helped because they didn't want a war with Iran either. That was the end of 2007, early 2008. And the more recent, I mentioned Syria. Not many people know that there are enough honest people in the intelligence apparatus, not only in CIA, but in DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, that when John Kerry got up on the 30th of August and said, we know that Bashar al-Assad arranged those chemical attacks in outside of Damascus, we know. You know, I converted it to a Word document, Scott, and I found out that he said, we know, 35 times, justifying Shakespeare's remark, methinks he doth protest too much. Long story short, they didn't know. As a matter of fact, my former colleagues knew that the rebels had sarin, that the range of the missiles that were said to come from the government-controlled areas were not long enough to reach the impact zones, and so it was equally likely, if not more likely, but the logic of the situation, that it was the rebels that did those things to provoke the U.S. into the war. My colleagues made that point to everyone that would listen, and I think the president knew that he had an insurrection on his time because they weren't going to do the same job they did on Iraq, and that's one reason, one major reason, why within 20 hours, after Kerry said 35 times, we know that Bashar al-Assad did it, and that the president has to move now because he drew that red line, within 20 hours, Obama got up in the Rose Garden and said, no, we're ready to attack Syria, but the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has told me we could do that today, we could do it tomorrow, or we could do it next week or next month. There's no, quote, time sensitivity, end quote, to this. So I'm going to go to Congress to seek authorization. Wow, we're blowing out of our minds. Now, why did he do that? There are a whole bunch of reasons. But one of the main reasons was that the honest, substantive analysts within the CIA were going to raise one holy hell, unlike their silence before Iraq. So I just wanted to clarify that, because they're good guys and they're bad guys. There's the other CIA that does the torture and the kidnapping and all that other stuff. That's not the CIA I belong to.
Yeah, although nowadays, I mean, the analysts mostly just sit around plotting to assassinate people with robots and stuff, right?
Well, no. What I just said is that there are some honest ones there that are not afraid to speak out when the Secretary of State lies 35
times. Yeah, no, I know. I mean, hey, Phil Jarali reported that they were going to resign over it. You know, yeah. The White House had to resort to putting out a fake intelligence assessment that sort of pretended to be a CIA assessment. And then Phil later reported at the American Conservative that there was a real revolt. Not just they refused, but they said, we'll all quit. You won't be able to hide that.
Yeah, when you say a fake intelligence assessment, that's the correct adjective. It was fake, but they didn't even try. That is, the White House didn't even try to represent it as an intelligence assessment. It was a unique animal. I'd never seen a, quote, government assessment, unquote, that purported to be an intelligence assessment. That's how careful they were. And, you know, I have to put my take my hat off to Martin Dempsey. For once, we have a chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff who has some courage and some integrity. He didn't want this darn war, and he told the president that. As a matter of fact, he told Congress that Article 1 of the Constitution requires a declaration of war by the Congress, and that he wasn't going to participate in anything less than that. Now, when push came to shove, and it looked like Kerry was going to prevail, one of the things that I believe happened, and I can't prove this one, but I believe it happened, Dempsey went to Obama that evening and said, look, Mr. President, with all due respect, we, the Joint Chiefs, know that you really favor those young Turks there in the White House, the tough guys, and those tough women that you got, the UN and Susan Rice. We know all that. But, you know, Mr. President, how do I say this? They don't know diddly about war, and we do, okay? Neither does John Kerry know diddly about it. Driving boats up the Mekong does not qualify you as a strategic thinker, Mr. President, and there's no such thing as Kerry described it, and, quote, unbelievably small war if we attack Syria. There's no such thing as that. So, Mr. President, if you order us to use our armed forces to start a war with Syria, you know, another thing that's going to happen is the reporters, you know, they all beat me up. You know, they come and they say, now, General Dempsey, why couldn't you wait 2 or 3 days till the UN inspectors came back from in and around Damascus and reported on who may have done or what those chemical-like attacks were like? Why couldn't you wait 2 or 3 days? And, you know, Mr. President, I'm going to have to say, that beats the hell out of me. Go ask the president. So here we had, like Iran, like the situation with respect to attacking Iran at the end of 2007, here we had a very, very similar situation where the Joint Chiefs wanted no part of getting involved with a widened war, including Syria, and they had the support of honest intelligence analysts. So if I seem a little sensitive to, you know, to saying that both sides of this twin-eagled agency are equally culpable of the miscreants that's been going on, please understand that there's been some good work done. And you know, I've been around for 50 years, Scott, and I've never before been able to say that, for example, that Iran estimate, that any national intelligence estimate actually played a huge role in preventing a war. But I can say that about this one honest estimate from November 2007.
Well, and they've stuck by it this whole time, too, for 5 years now.
Yeah, that's the wonder. Now, tomorrow, Liar-in-Chief James Clapper is going before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Every year they have this orchestrated worldwide threat briefing, okay? So Clapper gets up there. John Brennan will be there from the CIA. They'll have a couple of military types. Now, it would be really interesting if in Clapper's testimony, he weakens on this Iran thing. So far, wonder of wonders, And I think it's because the analysts have sort of kept a tight rein on him, saying, look, General Clapper, we know that you like to say things that aren't quite true. Don't say things that aren't quite true about Iran, okay? Because you got a insurrection on your hands. So I don't anticipate that he'll back off. I don't anticipate that he'll say, no, Iran is working on a nuclear weapon again. But if he does, watch out.
Yeah, well, I guess he could still screw it up. He's been fighting for it pretty hard so far, but we'll see how it goes. All right, now here's the problem. We're almost at our break, and then we're only going to have like 10 minutes to talk about Robert Gates. And it seems like there's an entire discussion about back when you knew him and how the end of the Cold War happened on his watch and he had no idea and how hilarious all of that is. But then also then there's an entire new era of Robert Gates and his career under Bush and Obama, two major failures, two major losses at war on his watch that somehow are spun as victories. So I'm wondering if you're going to be willing to stay for another segment past the top of the hour news, now that we've talked about how great the CIA analysts are for the whole first segment here.
I was going to say I'd be happy to do that. Let's just say I'd be willing to do that.
Okay, good. He'll settle for willing, everybody. I'll settle for willing. That's great. All right, so now tell me about, very briefly, tell me about when you first met Robert Gates. And we'll do his real history when we get back from this break.
Yeah, well, he was working as a Soviet analyst on the Middle East when I came back short of tour from Europe. The branch chief had died, and I was asked to take over his role. It was an incredibly bright branch, the best in the agency. Mel Goodman, several others were in that branch. And what I learned about Bobby Gates is that the second day he was an analyst, he started inquiring around some of the older folks. Now, how long did it take the area chief to become an area chief? And how long did it take the division chief? And then, you know, so his ambition was just so transparent that everyone sort of watched him meander around up the line. And it was a very divisive influence in the branch. And I told him so in writing in the first fitness report I did on him. That did not endear me to him, but it certainly made me feel better as I watched his career unfold.
Yeah, it's always, you can't really fault him as, you know, as far as his priorities. He gets it done, right? That's how you become the Secretary of Defense.
Well, he lets himself be used by Brzezinski or by, you know, Casey, as long as it means an upward swing for Bobby Gates. And the worst.
All right, well, hold it there. I'm sorry. We got to go. Hang on. It's Ray McGovern, everybody. We're going to take this short break. We'll be back to talk about Robert Gates and the Cold War after this. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, now peace activist, co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, which shouldn't be too much to ask, you know? But anyway, yeah. Contrary to that, go ahead and tell us about Robert Gates and how it really works over there.
Yeah, well, you know, Sanity was a niche industry here in Washington when we started it up in January of 2003. Our first memo was on the same day as Colin Powell's speech. Suffice it to say, we gave him a C-minus for content.
No, no, no. Let's go back. Let's talk about Robert Gates. We all know about how good you are on Iraq. Let's talk about how bad Robert Gates is on the USSR. Because he was under you, and you were filing bad reports on him for being so ambitious, but very quickly he became the deputy director. How's that?
Well, it's almost a funny story if it weren't so tragic. He schmoozed with all my superiors, right? And they didn't heed my warnings. And long story short, 10 years later, everybody, my superiors, young and old, of all grades and rank, they're all working for Bobby Gates. Why? Because he ingratiated himself with Bill Casey, the troglodyte who came in with Ronald Reagan to run the CIA, the fellow who saw a Soviet under every rock in Nicaragua, okay? Now, Bobby Gates was able to see three Soviets under every rock in Nicaragua, and so he got to be head of analysis, and, you know, that's only, that's, you know, symbolic or a metaphor, I suppose, but it's not far from the truth. Now, what did he do then? Well, then he cashiered the people who know things about the Soviet Union, Mel Goodman. Mel Goodman was asked to shepherd an estimate. Were the Soviets behind all terrorism in the world? And Mel came up with the estimate. He says, no. As a matter of fact, they discourage communist parties. They don't. Terrorism is not a good thing for the Russians. They don't see it as something they promote. Well, Mel Goodman had to leave, or he quit in disgust when Casey arranged to have some other folks write the correct answer. So what happened there, and why it's important, Scott, is that Casey and Gates really kind of drained the academic, the intelligence analysis ranks of all the smart people on the Soviet Union, and put in people like John McLaughlin, who bubbled up to be the deputy director, Doug McKechnie, and they just hewed to the Soviet, to the to the Gates line that, Gorbachev, he's just a clever commie. Don't believe it. The Soviet Party, the Communist Party, Soviet Union, forget about it. They'll stay in power forever. And so as a result, the institution missed the fall of the Soviet Union, their most important target since World War II. Mm-hmm. Now,
A big untold part of this story because, you know, you'll see reference all the time if you watch, you know, Discovery Channel type versions of the way things go, that sort of thing. And they'll always talk about how, they won't always talk about it, but they'll sometimes mention, I guess is the better way to say it, they'll sometimes mention that, yeah, and the CIA and the American intelligence community were caught by surprise by this. But they never say it's because they had such a political interest in building up an imaginary Soviet Union into being 12 feet tall that they couldn't help but miss what was really happening in front of them that they were paying no attention to whatsoever.
Yeah, you know, it's worse than that, Scott. Let me explain. You know, people talk about the intelligence before the Iraq War as being mistaken. It wasn't. It was fraud. It was fraudulent. So, too, with the intelligence on the Soviet Union, it was fraudulent. These were people much more interested in their career progression than the truth. They knew. They knew that the Soviet Union was falling apart, but they wouldn't get promoted if they said so. So there were very few people like Mel Goodman that said, that's enough. I didn't come here to tell lies. I'm getting out of here. Very, very few. And so when it all happened, the institution fell on its face. But there are lots of Soviet analysts. Actually, the truth be told, I knew who they were. I was one of them myself. And in my one-on-ones with Secretary Shultz and the Vice President, Bush was his name, George H.W. Bush, I told them the real deal.
I was just about to ask you that. Look, you talked to Bush. You were his morning briefer, basically, right?
Yeah, and when Shultz, you know, and later in his memoir, he says, you know, I came to distrust everything I was being told by Gates and Casey. Well, I know that I was giving him the straight scoop. And when, for example, TASS announced, as I'm walking in Shultz's door, that Gorbachev had invited Shultz to come to the Soviet Union, well, you know, the school solution was, no, don't, he's a clever commie. And I told Shultz, he's the real deal, because I know the guys that really know about the Soviet Union tell me, and I trust them, and I know enough about it myself to say, you ought to try him out, Mr. Shultz. Don't be misled by these tendentious careerists that know better but can't say better because they want their next promotion. So so it was a mixed story. The tough guys were getting the truth, but it was just an accident of history that the guys that I knew would tell the truth, and my own experience allowed me to feed Schultz and Weinberger even, and George H.W. Bush, what we considered to be Gorbachev, the real deal. Matter of fact, one of the fun things was the George H.W. Bush singer. Now, Ray, why do people say Gorbachev? What all that stuff, you know? I used to teach Russian stuff. I said, well, I thought I'd spare him the orthography, you know, Mr. Wilshire. After good, so I didn't do any of that. I said, look, just say garbage. And then say off. And accent the off. Okay, garbage off. That's it. Oh, you got it. And he was the first one to get it. So there were all kinds of neat little things, funny some of them. But the real deal was that we knew what was going on there. And Casey and Gates also knew, okay, they weren't mistaken. They just wanted to build these missile systems and everything else.
Yeah.
And
well,
Casey,
now,
maybe
but Ray,
not.
When George H.W. Bush was the director of the CIA, he was the one who commissioned the Team B study, where they, you know, really started the ball rolling on heating the Cold War back up after detente and the dawn of the Reagan era and all that buildup, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that was his major sin as CIA director, and he lasted, well, he's just 1 year at the helm. I didn't realize that at the time. I enjoyed working for him, and I enjoyed briefing him, but the more I learned about George H.W. Bush from Bob Perry and people who really looked into it at the time, the more I consider him a total waste as not only as past president, but as head of the CIA, because
now,
he
see,
did.
That sounds kind of crazy to somebody like me listening to you going, hey, I'm the CIA briefer who's talking to the vice president of the United States every morning, but now that I'm reading Bob Perry going back, now I really understand what was going on. It seems like you would be the one informing Bob Perry what's really going on.
This speaks volumes for Bob Perry, but the real deal here is this. I had no idea that the vice president and Don Gregg, his assistant, and others were knee-deep or neck-deep in the Big Muddy. And the Big Muddy, of course, was Iran-Contra, okay? I had no idea about that because the substantive analysis was kept off against these illegal and constitutional activities. So that's what I'm talking about. In other words, I could tell about the Soviet Union, you know what's going on elsewhere in the world, but I had no idea of his deep immersion with Aldi North and all those other people. So I did learn that from Bob Perry, and I'm very grateful for being able to do that.
Yeah, that's interesting about the compartmentalization there, where you're the CIA morning briefer, and he knows that much more to you about CIA operations going on, which I know wasn't entirely a CIA op or anything, but the Enterprise and all that. But
well, there was such secrecy surrounding this, of course, since it was so damn illegal that, I'm not surprised I didn't know. Every now and then I spoke up when the substantive question came up, like there was one time when they were grousing about Mary McGorry saying that every one of the Contra Directorate were ex-Somocistas, you know, a secret police for Somoza. And I said, well, actually, that happens to be the case. Oh, no, come on, Ray. That's like saying all the Bundeswehr are Nazis. I said, no. It's like saying the SS, because the secret police of the Somoza was the SS, was the Gestapo, and every single member of that Contra Director used to be in that Gestapo. Well, you better give me a memo on that. So I did, but they didn't care. They had other priorities, and the less they knew about that, the better. So that was my one major fling at setting them straight on that, and I knew darn well they weren't interested in the real answer.
All right. Well, and so now, back to Gates on this. How deep was he in the Iran-Contra thing? Because he was not the deputy director. He was the deputy director of CIA at the time.
He was eyeballs deep, okay? He was eyeballs deep. And the proof of it is...
He completely skated, though, right? Go back to the 80s. He didn't get in trouble at all when everybody else around him fell. Is that right?
That's right. He lied, of course, and even the prosecutor or the investigators said he lied. He escaped indictment just barely by the skin of his teeth. But the real lesson mention here is that in 1991, when he was up for being cleared or nominated and approved as director of the CIA, Bush, George H.W. Bush, expended all manner of political capital to get him in there. There were 31 senators that voted against him at the end. Why did he do that? Because Gates knew where the bodies were buried.
Yeah, keep
if Gates went into the CIA, he could destroy all those things, and George H.W. Bush could, you know.
Now, Ray, we got to go to the top of the hour news. When we get back, we're going to talk all about the surges and the Gates's two failed wars and all of that as Secretary of Defense. So we'll be back at 6 after. You can go ahead and take a break if you want. Come back.
Okay.
It's Ray McGovern. RayMcGovern.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Appreciate you tuning in. I'm talking with Ray McGovern. He's got this new piece at consortiumnews.com. I can't find the damn thing. I got it here. Oh, I know. Nope, that's not it. Oh, here. No Tears for the Real Robert Gates. That's at consortiumnews.com. We're talking about the real legacy of the former Secretary of Defense. He's got a big PR campaign and selling his book and all of that going on right now. And it's funny, like, how can you be the Secretary of War and lose two wars and then parade around like you're a big hero in your neck brace? And everybody goes, wow, you're such a great guy. We can learn so much from you, like how to lose two wars. But nobody even asks him that. Everybody acts like he's, you know, Caesar. He's come home from his triumphant conquests.
Well, Scott, the narrative is that not that he lost two wars, but that he saved two wars that were going south. Now,
I don't remember that happening, though. When did that happen?
Well,
I was watching, too. I mean, from Texas, but still as close as I can.
You have to look at things from the Bush and Cheney perspective on Iraq. You see, at the end of 2006, there was bedlam in Iraq. Nothing was going well. It looked very clear that it was a fool's errand and we got to get out of there. And so one of the congressmen who had some guts encouraged the establishment of what they called the Iraq Study Group. Who did they get to head that up? Bush loyalist James Baker.
Yeah, and they had Sandra Day O'Connor and Vernon Jordan. And
yeah. And what did
the
they
establishment.
Come up with?
The old guys.
Yeah, but even they, that's the story here, even they said, it's a fool's errand, we got to get out of there, the sooner the better, the worst thing to do would be prolong the agony. Now, simultaneously, the generals, Abi Zaid, head of CENTCOM, KC, head of the ground forces out there in Iraq, they came to Congress in September of 2006 and said, please, Senate 11, please, no more troops, okay? No, please. The last thing we need is more troops, because then the Iraqi government will get it and never get it to its head. It has to work out a deal, Sunni and Shia. So please, one thing, please, so like, don't throw me in the dryer patch, but this for real, okay? No troops. What happens? Well, Bush and Cheney go to their neocon advisors and say, what does that mean, no troops? And the neocon advisors at the American Enterprise Institute know, well, Mr. President, that means you lose a war on your watch. And so the president says, well, wait a second, I don't want to do that. How can I avoid that? And the word was surge. Surge 30,000 troops into Iraq. Make sure that you can tamp down the violence by ethnic cleansing. And I use that word advisedly. Ethnic cleansing the capital of Iraq, Baghdad, from a predominantly Shia, a predominantly Sunni city into a predominantly Shia city. And that's what we could watch in satellite photography. The lights go out, okay, in those neighborhoods. Now, that was the surge, okay? Now, what did it do? It bought Cheney and Bush enough time so that it could ride out into the western sunset not having lost the war. What did it cost? 1,000 U.S. troops. What did it achieve? Zilch. Look at Iraq now. Last Sunday, last time I checked the figures, 70 people killed, more than that injured. The place is falling apart. The country is destroyed. The only good that's come out of any of this has been from the perspective of Israel, which very much wanted us to destroy Iraq, remove Saddam Hussein. And so we did. And they looked on that in a very myopic way as progress. So it was a disaster. Now, what happened with respect to Afghanistan when some...
Now, wait a minute. I mean, that's not entirely fair, because I think that Iran and al-Qaeda benefited a lot from that war, too, not just Israel.
Okay. I stand corrected.
Okay,
Iran,
I'm sorry. Now go ahead, Afghanistan.
Okay. All right. So surge is a really good word in Washington because, people like Sarah Palin, 2 years later, Sarah Palin saying, look, what we need to do. She's a strategic thinker of a great repute, of course. She said, what we need to do here it is. She tells Katie Couric, quote, a surge in Afghanistan will also lead us to victory there, as it has proven to have done in Iraq. Now, that sounds good to Bobby Gates. Now, I should probably finish the Iraq part of this, because I hadn't noted that Don Rumsfeld himself was going real wobbly on the war in Iraq. Mm-hmm. So you had the Iraq study group
at the end of 2006.
At the end of 2006, yeah. And actually, when Bush and Cheney realized that if they cut back there, they would lose the war on their watch, and decided to surge, Rumsfeld, I suppose to his credit, says, well, I think the military's right. I don't think it's a good idea. So they canned him. Now, who are they going to get to be defense secretary? Well, Bobby Gates comes out to Crawford, and Bush says, no, look, this is what's going to happen. We're going to do a surge, and you're not going to have to do anything. We have this really pretty guy with 12 rows of medals. His name is Petraeus. He's got all the merit badges from his Boy Scout days, and you know all about that. He's going to do all the dirty work. All you have to do is go to Tampa and cashier Abi Zaid, go out to Iraq, tell Casey he can have a sinecure in the Joint Chiefs, and we'll do the surge. And Gates says, does that mean, are you saying, I can be Secretary of Defense? And yeah, that's the deal. Oh, I can do that. Now, Gates had been on the Iraq study group. He knew what the deal was. He knew it was effective, but he didn't be Secretary of State. I mean, Secretary of Defense. So that's Iraq. Now, 2 years later, some idiot persuades Obama to hire Bobby Gates back on, or let him stay as Secretary of Defense. Now, Afghanistan's in the same shape. It's going down the tubes. What are they going to do? Well, Obama didn't have the guts to say, look, this is a fool's errand just like Iraq. We need to downsize, get out of it. Instead of that, surge. That's what Bobby Gates pushed. Surge. Again, 30,000 folks. Now look at Afghanistan today. It's a basket case. We're going to be driven out of there with our tail between our legs, just like we were out of Iraq, having killed another 2,000, 3,000 U.S. troops, not to mention Afghans. So last time I checked the Bible, they're people too. And it's just a destroyed society. So, this surge business, it makes no sense at all. And for the pundits and for the establishment Washington, official Washington, be singing the praises of the surges still, well, that's the only thing that Bobby Gates can trade on. And that's why I wrote the book now, okay?
Right.
Because next year it's going to be clear that both were disasters. So he gets the book out now, gets on all the TV programs. The guy is a Teflon-coated charlatan, and you can quote me on it. I saw that the first time I supervised him.
Yeah. Hey, and we can end on this note about your CIA analyst you love so much, according to, I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce his name, so it's really hard to memorize, but it's Little America is the book, and he's a Washington Post reporter, and they serialized it in the Washington Post, or parts of it, and one of the things that he talks about in there is that the CIA analyst came up with a report in 2009 that told Obama, this would have been the fall of 09, that told him that the initial surge that had already taken place, I believe it was 30 in the spring and then another 30,000 in the summer, the CIA report said, nah, it's made a negligible difference. It's not going to make a difference in the long-term outcome of the war if you give them another 30 or 60 now, so you might as well not even bother. And how Obama, you know, I guess had heard what was in the report, already knew what was in it, and so refused to read it because he knew it was telling him to not bother surging. But he went ahead with his political advice, which was you can't end two wars or the Republicans will call you a sissy. So he said, oh, no, I'd rather get tens of thousands more people killed than be called a sissy. And so...
Yeah, I've checked with the doctors at George Washington University Hospital for how far along they are on a backbone implant. I'm thinking that, you know, if we get one in Obama in the next year or two, we have some hope. But they're 5 years away from that, and unless he gets testosterone treatment or something like that, the guy is from hunger.
The thing it was the right gamble politically. He got reelected. He did not have a controversy over leaving Afghanistan, which he would have had. And it may have made the difference. And so from his point of view, more power for him. It worked, you know?
You're not suggesting that politics trumps everything, even getting people killed, are you, Scott?
Yeah, well, this is why I don't think there should be a government at all. Starting with the CIA, no offense.
I think there's some good things happening. We prevented the war in Syria.
That's true.
And that was largely the American people. Even
there's
the
a big backlash
people.
About the NSA right now, too. I'm sorry, we got to go. But you're right. Thanks for ending on a positive note right there. We did stop the war in Syria, and they helped.
Take care now.
And that is a big deal. Thanks very much. Ray McGovern, everybody. The heroic Ray McGovern. ConsortiumNews.com. No tears for the real Robert Gates. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I'm glad Ray writes what he writes. And I detest Robert Gates, too. And it's terrible the way that he gets away with pretending to be such a moderate guy. That's my problem, right? I'm too animated. Look at Bill Kristol. He's another one of these guys with his giant Cheshire cat grin. But boy, he never gets mad. Boy, he's always perfectly pleased. Well, you know, the correct answer is some ridiculous thing, right? But, anyway. I don't know who considers him charming, but apparently people do. But Robert Gates, you know, like I talked about on the show last week, Sean Hannity interviewed him and said, say this, say that. Oh, wow, you say this. That's really bad. And everything Hannity said, Gates got to walk it back. Well, you know, this is not quite as bad as you make it out to be. Very reasonable. Distinguished old gentleman. Yes, who helped save two wars from disaster. As long as you don't define what that means. We'll just stick with the surge worked. It fits right on our banner. We'll just repeat that. All right, John Pfeffer's coming up on the show. He's got great stuff to say about Iraq. I know because I read what he wrote about it. And also, he's got great stuff to say about America's Asia pivot. I know because I read what he wrote about it. So hang tight for that. All right, now, wait a minute. What time is it? God dang. All right, I got a little bit of time. Let me talk about some news here. We got some news. Egypt. Morsi's yelling, screaming. He's on trial. The anniversary, the third anniversary of the Arab Spring has come and gone. A lot of protesters killed. The basic rundown being, in 11, the so-called political left, which I guess, you know, they were the labor union types and maybe the more hipster, inner-city living type people from Cairo or whatever. I don't want to diminish them too much. The political left, they allied with, at least temporarily, with the Muslim Brotherhood, the only, I mean, they're officially outlawed, but they were tolerated under the Mubarak dictatorship. They're the only center of power outside of the state at all. And they combined together to overthrow the military dictatorship of Hosni Mubarak, and then the Muslim Brotherhood, they were the ones who were organized. They were the ones who had their act together. The liberals never did get their act together. We covered this, and really, yes, it's true, I relied on Adam Morrow instead of having 100,000 other different reporters on the subject or whatever, but this guy, you know, he is calling the score perfect the whole time. I mean, it's the reason I know all about it, and it all works. The model fits. The liberals never got their act together. So the military prevented, well, through their sock puppet courts, prevented the real leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood from running. So their fourth stringer, Mohamed Morsi, ended up becoming the president. You know, it would be like, I don't know, whatever loser Republican you hate the most, you know, them having to settle for him, something like that. And then they ruled like a bunch of jerks. They never did, I guess, really reach out to the political left to try to form a kind of, in metaphor terms, a Republican-Democrat alliance, no matter what their real differences, to agree to not have a military form of government, to have a democratic form of government and regular elections, and you win some and you lose some, and whatever, which is not perfect, and it ain't anarcho-capitalism like it ought to be, but it sure is a hell of a lot better than a military dictatorship that just tortures people to death all the time. And so they never did make that compromise. They never did, you know, ally with the rise of the Democratic Party to their Republicans. And so then what did the liberals do? Last summer, they teamed up with the military to overthrow the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood is now completely banned and outlawed. All their what's left of them are protesting and being killed in the streets. And, of course, you hear all of a sudden the human rights crowd isn't very human rightsy because it's the Empire's sock puppet military stooges who are doing the killing here. So they get away with it. At least there's the side benefit is you get to see the glaring hypocrisy about, boo-hoo, Assad killed the civilian. Say the Americans, right, who've killed more, the American government's killed more civilians than anybody else in the 21st century by a hell of a long shot, right? Including having Assad torture people to death for us just back a few years ago under the Republicans. But, Assad bombed somebody, huh? But meanwhile, the military dictatorship in Egypt massacres them in the streets. Nah, Obama doesn't have a word to say about that. Back during the coup, 1,000 people were killed, or right around there, 900 and something. Hey, that's a third of a September 11th. That's a huge thing. Maybe, you know, life is cheap over there in the Orient or whatever kind of view you believe in or whatever, but if you were one of them, that's a hell of a lot of people to be murdered in a giant massacre taking place to coincide with a coup d'etat where a military government overthrows the democratically elected government. But, oh well. Hey, America's business has got to be done, right? And, of course, by America's business, Israel's business. They want a military dictatorship in Egypt. They get a military dictatorship in Egypt. That's the bottom line. The Americans, they could deal with the Muslim Brotherhood, but not with Benjamin Netanyahu screaming. Oh my God, another thing for that guy to scream about all the time. Forget it. We'll just go, we'll have this guy, Sisi, run for president. Right? Just like Saddam Hussein used to run for president. What a joke. So anyway, whatever religion you believe in, may your God or gods bless the people of Egypt, the victims of the American Empire again, their democracy canceled. And, you know, the civilian political people over there, they blew it. I asked Adam Morrow, man, how come the Muslim Brotherhood and the liberal labor union types couldn't work out something? And he says, you know, they were all just political neophytes, man. They blew it. All of them. They just blew it. And so the military came right back. And, you know, the military's throwing up roadblocks all along. I'm sure I named 2% of them or something just now. But anyway, it's a sad story in Egypt, but it's an important one, and it's all America's fault. That's the real thing, is that, to paraphrase, I think not very roughly, our hero, Eric Margulies, the Egyptian military is the American military. They're just part of the empire. That's it. They're not an independent force in the world. Their military, those guys, are our guys. Simple as that. So, can't get much simpler than that. Elections canceled. Algeria 93, Islamists win, elections canceled. Gaza 05, elections held at the insistence of the Americans. Islamists win, election results canceled. Egypt 2011, 2012, elections held, Islamists win. 2013, elections canceled. If you held a plebiscite in whatever you call it, a referendum in Syria right now, no one really doubts that Assad would win. He's got the coalition. He's got all the Muslims, all the Alawites, all the Alawites, who they're sort of kind of Shiites, but sort of kind of their own thing. But anyway, he's got all of them. He's got all the Assyrian and Chaldean Christians and whatever other kind of Christians that go back 2,000 years that live there on his side. And he's got all the Sunnis who don't want an Islamist state on his side too. So there's your majority for the dictatorship, for the military, for the secular military dictatorship. It's preferable to a Saudi-style emirate where people get their heads cut off for not doing what they're told and believing what they're told to believe all the time. As bad as the Syrian police state is, it ain't that bad according to a majority of Syrians right now. But that's why the Americans would never do such a thing as allow them to hold a vote and see. I mean, it'd be pretty hard to do in the middle of a war anyway, but of course, again, that's America and Saudi Arabia bankrolling the three Al-Qaedas, the Islamist Front, Jabhat al-Nusra, and ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Sham, or Iraq and Syria, as they call it. Elections? No. If the Americans believed in democracy in the Middle East, they would have to believe in it so much that they'd be willing to lose their influence in each and every state in the Middle East where they helped it take hold. Now, does that sound like it makes any sense to you? Even in Iraq, where they fought a war for 8 years for the Shiite majority to take over the capital city, the Shiite majority, including their hand-picked sock puppet, Nouri al-Maliki of the Dawah Party, told them, don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. And the army had to sneak out in the middle of the night without telling anyone, saying, yes, we're preparing to leave a week from Tuesday, and then hauling ass that night because they're afraid they're going to get sniped at all the way to Kuwait. And that was the majority that America, quote-unquote, liberated, except for all the ones that got killed during it. But that was for the majority Shiite Arabs political parties to take power in the country. And as soon as they were done winning, as soon as that ethnic cleansing campaign that Ray talked about was over, Gates's genocide against the Sunni Arabs, as soon as that was over, okay, now beat it, said the Dawah Party. Too bad, too late to cancel those elections. I told you back in 06 that you should call off the trial and put Saddam back in power, but you didn't listen. Okay, I was joking, but still, it wasn't too late then. Remember when they lynched him in the barn? That was America bringing the rule of law to Iraq. They lynched Saddam in a barn with the crowd chanting, Muqtada, Muqtada, Muqtada. Yeah, that's democracy and modernity for you. Muqtada, 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 they chanted. Things are looking really good over there right now. Don't you worry about it. Man, I don't have time to talk about Bernanke. Maybe tomorrow we'll talk about Bernanke. I like talking about Bernanke. Maybe I'll interview somebody about Bernanke. Coming up, John Pfeffer. Oh, man, I had a whole thing to talk about Snowden, too, man. All of that stuff, the NSA stuff. Dang it. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Hey, I'm going to be on Daily Paul Radio tonight with Allison Bricker. I guess during and or maybe it's after the State of the Union. And then I guess Rand Paul's going to have a response, and so I'm going to have my say. Ow, I bit my tongue. I'm going to have my say after that over there at Daily Paul Radio tonight. Something, I don't know, check it out over there. DailyPaul.com. All right, next up on the show is our old friend John Pfeffer. He's co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, and he's the author of several books, including Crusade 2.0. A Tom Dispatch regular, he is currently writing a book about Eastern Europe 25 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And his own website is johnpfeffer.com. And you know, I'm sorry, John, I meant to catch up on all your great stuff, your tour of Eastern Europe and all of that stuff. I never did. That website is now on my pile of books I'm supposed to get to. And maybe it'll happen someday. I really would like to, if that counts for anything. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Fine. Thanks for having me back on.
All right. Good times. Hey, listen, so you've written two very good, very important, very different articles I'd like to talk with you about. I'd like to spend more time on the Asia thing, really. But let's start with Iraq, revisiting the Pottery Barn Rule. The sub-headline here reads that in Iraq, the U.S. broke a nation of human beings, and it owes them an apology and a restitution. And I appreciate you being subtle and understated about it, because, you know, that hardly gets across the devastation and the unraveling of Iraqi society. It wasn't just that there was a war there. It was every bit of what had been woven together there became unraveled and horrible and bloody during that American occupation. So go ahead and make your case. The floor is yours.
Well, and the unraveling continues. I mean, we continue to get reports of the devastation in Iraq today. And it's, as you know, U.S. troops for the most part have been withdrawn from Iraq. And this, you know, has been held up as one of Obama's, you know, chief accomplishments over the last few years, to actually end the war in Iraq and pull out U.S. troops. And of course, there was an attempt at one point to keep U.S. troops there, to negotiate some kind of status of forces agreement with the al-Maliki government. That failed. We deployed the so-called zero option. We pulled everybody out. Of course, we still have some folks there, some Marines at the U.S. Embassy, some trainers who are overseeing kind of provision of military supplies to the government. But for the most part, we're out. But, you know, we seem to have basically washed our hands of the situation, that we see we have no responsibility for the damage that we did. And so in the article, basically what I talk about is, number one, that we focus on this pottery barn thing, which is all about, you know, if you break it, you own it, which, of course, was not the pottery barn rule at all. With all retailers, basically, if you broke something, they wrote it off as a loss. And that really is what we've done. We've written Iraq off as a loss. And we seem to have no intention of doing the basic things. And the basic thing would be, number one, to apologize for what we did, and then to provide some form of restitution. And in the article, I talk about, you know,
the psychic pain that many of the veterans feel, and the tremendous guilt they have over their role in this, and the fact that there's so little they feel they can do. They try as much as possible in some cases to find Iraqi refugees who have settled in the United States. But what I imagine is some other form of restitution in which the United States, in some sense, tries to, you know, repair the damage that the United States was at least in part responsible for. And so that's what the article is about.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny, you couldn't really put the military back there, active duty military back there in the middle of this violence. And I mean, I guess there are some places where you could send troops where, you know, they could do something nice without, you know, being in the middle of a firefight or something like that. But maybe they could start in Laos and pick up the cluster bomb units laying around in Laos and Cambodia where, you know, I mean, for the active duty, as far as the veterans that you're talking about, you know, hey, everybody go and do whatever you want. But I kind of envision ending the entire empire and putting the entire army to work cleaning up depleted uranium dust in Kosovo and Serbia and in Iraq, of course, and cleaning up so-called dud munitions in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia and on like that. There's a lot to be done.
Absolutely. And you know, I wasn't imagining, of course, active duty returning to Iraq, and that is...
No, I didn't mean to sound like I was trying to contradict you on that, but I was just kind of going off my own direction about what actual use the U.S. Army could be in the world. How about making up for past sins, and then we would have a whole army worth of guys out there cleaning up cluster bomb units, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there have been some efforts... not for active duty, but for veterans to return to Vietnam and do what they can in that situation. And, you know, there have been quite a few veterans who have participated in that. But that's been, you know, that's like 20, 30, 40 coming up now, years after the case. And are we going to wait 30, 40 years, you know, for things to get even worse in Iraq before we turn our attention there again? I think we do have to think about what our responsibility, not as a military, not as the Pentagon's responsibility, even if it was the Pentagon who was responsible for this, but our responsibility as a nation toward Iraq, and not just, as you say, toward Iraq, toward all the countries in the world that we have, you know, spent years and decades tearing apart in many ways.
Well, you know, there's a real problem there because... You know, whenever we talk about we and they like that, ultimately, most of the time we're talking about our governments and their policies. And you can't really have transfer payments from our government to anyone in Iraq without it being the wrong people in Iraq, right? They can't just put $10,000 in everybody's pocket and call it even that way and say sorry, which would be nice, but it would take magic to do, right? So then there's really no way to do it without just giving the money to the Badr Corps and letting them decide who gets it, their favorite torturers or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I don't really envision, you know, a huge transfer payment in this sense. Of course, you know, we have seen the Pentagon engage in those kinds of payments to the victims of drone attacks and so on. But what I envision is something, you know, more on the lines of Civil Corps of Engineers or Army Corps of Engineers. You know, folks go in there and build bridges, repair schools, build roads, infrastructure development, rather than payments to particular individuals or to particular neighborhoods.
Well, back to the question of security, though. I mean, they really can't do that without getting killed.
Oh, at the moment, it's going to be very difficult, especially in the areas that are under, you know, the greatest conflict right now, such as Fallujah and so forth. There are other areas of the country that are less conflict-ridden, and I suspect it would be possible to do it there. But this is a long-range plan. This is something that I think we have to commit to as a country. It's not something that we're going to do in the midst of battle, either in Iraq or Afghanistan. It's something we have to reorient our foreign policy toward. It'd be a foreign policy of reconstruction rather than a foreign policy of destruction.
Yeah. Well, what about you know, because I don't know, I worry that maybe conservative Republican types would just be too humiliated by such a thing. Maybe we could compromise and just promise to not be in any wars for 50 years, no matter what, and then hope the Iraqis will settle for that. That we promise not to do to anyone what we did to you for at least 50 years.
Yeah, well, I'm sure
that was Eric Garrison's idea.
Sure,
that way
Iraqis
we're not having to mandate a new policy of any kind. We just promise to stop having policies.
Yeah. Well, you know, the symbolism, for instance, of U.S. policy toward Japan and towards nuclear weapons. I mean, you know, we, in some sense, could go, Obama as president, could go to Hiroshima, and there has been no standing president who has visited Hiroshima. And if Obama went there, it wouldn't make sense to say, well, of course, we're going to repair Japanese society or repair Hiroshima or whatever. I mean, the bombing of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, took place a long time ago. But there is great symbolism for the president to go there and say, you know, I'm recommitting to nuclear abolition, recommitting to, you know, a policy by which the United States makes dramatic cuts in our nuclear arsenal. I mean, that is an important kind of, that has important symbolism over and beyond anything, you know, we have done to support Japan after 1945 and its reconstruction efforts.
Yeah. Well, I was for the Paul Kucinich ticket, 08. Things could be a lot better by now in so many regions of the world if you think about it, how long it's been now that we could have been out of all these places for real and for good, you know? Oh, well.
Absolutely.
I don't get my way. That's not how it works.
Well, that brings us over to Asia, where we are theoretically involved in a pivot to reorient our foreign policy away from our failures and fiascos in the Middle East.
Now, here's the thing. We got very little time before we go out to this break, or, well, actually a minute and a half or so. But now, so is the pivot to Asia mostly just cover for withdrawing from the Middle East, and, well, we got to do something to make work the Army talks about in Africa, that, well, we're just looking for a mission because we don't have any?
Well, the U.S. has had a mission in the Pacific for quite some time. You could argue it ever since Teddy Roosevelt in the turn of the century. So in some sense, the Pacific pivot is a reassertion of U.S. mission in Asia. Mission might have changed somewhat, but for the most part, we're not talking about finding a new mission in a new part of the world. We're talking about an attempt to reassure our allies and to go up against what has emerged as really the only challenge to the United States in terms of world power in the world, and that would be China.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, I read, I believe it was Colonel Basevich in the Los Angeles Times talking about how, well, the Army's pivot to Africa is sort of their consolation prize for not really having anything to do with the pivot back to Asia. And so, well, they get to go ahead and invade Africa, occupy this, that, or the other country, you know, because they don't get to be part of containing China so much anymore.
You know, the Army still thinks it can kind of reinsert itself into Asia. It has put forward this Pacific Pathways Initiative, which, you know, is an attempt to say, hey, we're going to basically do what the Marines are doing. But it's pretty unlikely they're going to be able to convince the Pentagon as a whole to support it.
All right, well, hold it right there. When we get back, we're going to talk all about the Pacific pivot with John Pfeffer. He's got this great one at tomdispatch.com, The Empire's New Asian Clothes, Why America's Strategic Rebalance is Really Just Retreat. I like the sound of that. Hang tight. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy, only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with John Pfeffer. He's got a new piece at TomDispatch.com. Oh, I should tell you, that last piece, the Iraq piece, Revisiting the Pottery Barn Rule, I'm not sure if I mentioned, that's at FPIF.org, Foreign Policy in Focus. Great bunch of writers over there, FPIF.org, Iraq, Revisiting the Pottery Barn Rule. And so now we're talking about this piece at Tom Dispatch, which will be running on antiwar.com tomorrow. It's John Pfeffer, The Empire's New Asian Clothes. And then the subhead here is Why America's Strategic Rebalance is Really Just Retreat. And that sounds good to me, as I said, going out to break. But then I thought, man, that probably doesn't sound very good to people. Maybe we should call it Victory While We Retreat. What do you think?
Well, it's interesting that that you put it that way, because that's something I think the Obama administration would like to avoid. It would like to avoid any kind of association with Iraq, of course, and it wants to avoid kind of disturbing our allies. Our allies are, in this case, Japan, South Korea, to a certain extent, Indonesia, Thailand, certainly Australia, have been eager for the United States to pay more attention to Asia, not to retreat. And they have been urging the United States to stop, you know, pouring so much resources, so many resources into the Middle East, and to pour some of those resources into the Asia-Pacific region. And in part, the Pacific pivot is designed to allay their suspicions that the United States is in fact retreating. But if you look at the numbers, you see that the United States, in fact, has been retreating from Asia for the last several decades. We've seen a reduction in U.S. forces in Korea, on the Korean Peninsula, from around 70,000 back in the Nixon era to about 28,000 today. We've seen a reduction in Japan, and a further reduction planned when the Futenma Marine Air Force Base is closed, and they relocate those Marines in other places. And we have seen an effort by the Pentagon to say, hey, we are going to, you know, push some resources into the Asia-Pacific region. For instance, we're going to shift our balance of the fleet, the U.S. fleet, from 50-50 the Pacific and the rest of the world to 60-40 with the advantage to the Pacific. But again, if you look at the numbers, we're looking at actually a much smaller fleet. So it doesn't really matter what the ratio is. There's going to be fewer ships going to be there. And with, you know, belt tightening eventually going to take place in the Pentagon, it's not going to take place this year. We're going to see the beginning of it next year. We're going to see a reduction of forces overall. And that's going to have a profound impact on the region. And I can talk a little bit more about that if you like. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I want to get into all of that. But first of all, let me ask you this. Because, you know, whatever. I know most people don't agree with me about everything. But it seems to me like we don't even hardly really need a Navy at all. Give them an aircraft carrier too, a few good submarines. And it's not like we could ever have a war, a real war with China, without losing Los Angeles over it. So since that's off the table, then what are we even talking about here, other than pretending that China is an adversary worth arming up against, when really they're our best friend and trading partner other than the Canadians, and we have a long future of inhabiting this planet to look forward to together. And so what in the hell do we need a Navy at all for at this point, when we're allies with the EU, when the Russians don't hardly have one at all, and when the Chinese are only barely building theirs up because of our pivot and encirclement of them?
Mm-hmm. Well, you make a compelling argument, and certainly if you're sitting, you know, in the U.S. Trade Office, or you're sitting anywhere in Wall Street, or you're sitting with, you know, the firms, you know, the high-tech firms and the IT firms on the West Coast, they're all going to agree with you. It makes absolutely no sense to have any kind of military confrontation with China, especially when we have, you know, this pretty deep economic relationship with them. On the other hand, if you're sitting in the Pentagon or you're sitting in the president's office, it's a slightly different perspective, because what they're looking at is they're looking at Taiwan. We made basically a security commitment to Taiwan that we'd protect them in the case of any aggression on the part of the mainland. And in order to protect Taiwan, that's what we need the Navy for. I mean, we need a lot of other things, apparently. We also need to send Taiwan, you know, huge amounts of military weaponry. But that's the commitment the United States made. That's number one. I mean, that's that's where the conflict's going to come. It's not going to come, say, over, you know, China trying to invade Los Angeles or even some kind of conflict in Central America over resources or over oil in Africa or even in the South China Sea. The issue is going to be over Taiwan. Now, folks in the Pentagon might say they need the Navy for a couple other things. They might need the Navy in case of a quote-unquote contingency on the Korean Peninsula if something happened between North and South Korea. They need the Navy for dealing with counterterrorism operations, although, frankly, most of that's done with special operations.
Well, I'll try one question, John. Wouldn't that sort of be like losing Estonia or one of those further eastern NATO allies? Yeah, we didn't really mean it when we said we're willing to lose our capital city for yours, so sorry. I mean, if China decided they were really going to take Taiwan by force, I mean, do you think the American government would really be willing to get into a hydrogen bomb exchange with Beijing over that and lose American cities over Taiwan? Or our bluff would be called and, sorry, Taiwan, right? That's sure as hell what I would do.
Here's the thing. I don't think the Washington would make a decision like that. However,
I mean, that's their promise, but it's a hollow promise, right? Or not?
Well, here's the thing. China doesn't really have a very big nuclear capability. It's nothing like what Russia had or continues to have today.
No, a couple of dozen's pretty good, though, when it comes down to H-bombs.
Well, yes and no. I mean, one of the key elements of the Pacific Pivot, and it has been this way actually prior to the Pacific Pivot, is missile defense in the region. And China's quite upset in missile defense because it sees missile defense as basically eliminating deterrence, essentially making China's nuclear force unusable. Now, I don't think missile defense actually works, but, you know, this is all speculative. This is all hypothetical. China's, you know, concerned that, you know, it doesn't have the nuclear weapons to use. Any conflict, therefore, that involved Taiwan would not involve an exchange of nuclear weapons, or at least it wouldn't involve China using nuclear weapons. So, anyway, that's, I think, at some level, why the Pentagon argues that it needs the Navy. It still thinks that some kind of a conventional war would take place across the Taiwan Straits. Mm-hmm. But again, I mean, this is all wargaming. I mean,
Well, the Taiwanese military has been armed up at this point to the degree where they could at least hurt the Chinese badly for any attack, right? Make them pay for it if
they
not
could.
Win.
They could, but it's not like South Korea vis-a-vis North Korea. I mean, no. Essentially, in any kind of conflict involving Taiwan, it would require the United States to be, in some sense, the equalizer, whereas on the Korean Peninsula, South Korea can take care of itself in any kind of conflict with North Korea. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where we have the challenge. Now, that said, you know, the relationship between mainland and Taiwan is, you know, in some ways very similar to the relationship between the United States and China. The two countries are economically dependent on one another, or I should say Taiwan is economically dependent on mainland, not so much on Taiwan. There's an enormous amount of investment coming from Beijing into Taiwan. There's an enormous number of Taiwanese who operate factories in the mainland with Taiwanese workers who come over from Taiwan. So the economic relationship is very strong. If we're talking about any kind of potential conflict between Taiwan and China, you know, that too is mitigated by this very strong economic relationship.
Right, yeah, the status quo is pretty good, and it seems like from here, assuming nothing, no black swan kind of crazy thing happens, you would assume that they would eventually negotiate a Hong Kong-type status of autonomy and strong alliance and more or less, you know, shared sovereignty kind of a deal like that, that would be mutually beneficial, assuming, again, nothing bad happens. That's the future of those two states, right?
Well, I would like to believe that. I mean, but there is a pretty strong constituency in Taiwan that rejects that out of hand.
Yeah.
They haven't won in the elections recently. I mean, they were in charge for a while, but they didn't win in the previous election. But they still represent a significant portion of the population. Were that party to once again come into power, then we might see a different scenario. We might see an increase in tension. We might see Taiwan, the Taiwanese government, declare de facto, not just de facto, but de jure independence and seek status at the UN and other international organizations. That would be a problem from the main.
And now, John, I'm sorry, because I'm getting in your way and stepping all over your point, which I never really let you get back to, and we're almost out of time here if you want to wrap up.
Sure. I mean, the key thing I want to point out here is that as the United States is withdrawing from Asia, even as it declares that it's returning to the Pacific pivot, what it's effectively doing is pushing its allies out in front, arming our allies, involving them in ever more sophisticated modernization, ever more sophisticated trainings and maneuvers. We are pushing them to increase their spending on their own militaries. And so this is a major problem. One place in the world where there is a major arms race going on right now is Asia. We're seeing global military spending finally peak and decline over the last year or two, except in Asia. And the United States is in part responsible for this because it wants, in some sense, to withdraw under the cover of a major military upgrade on the part of our allies. And that's been very destabilizing. We see the results of that today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's supposed to be stabilizing, right? But it's the opposite, as everything
exactly.
We do. All right. Well, thanks very much. I'm sorry we're all out of time, but it's a great article, great couple of articles. Thanks again, John.
Been a pleasure. Take care.
All right, everybody. That's the great John Pfeffer, TomDispatch.com, and Foreign Policy and Focus, FPIF.org. Thanks for listening. Y'all, see you tomorrow.